on a week like all weeks, but a week of profound tragedy. Where there are tragedies all the time, but when the tragedies resonate, folks we know, or somehow ring in a kind of more direct connection, there's often a sense of like what do we do with this? How do we best practice? What's the right response? Grief, of course, is always a part of the right response. This practice of metta, loving kindness or benevolence, in its simplest form is the encouragement to cultivate the heart of kindness and to radiate it, as the chant says, over the entire world. I was thinking about this a couple weeks ago and thinking about how the heart of the metta instruction is to hook into this feeling that is natural and easy to have when we're in contact with that which is easy to love, like the people we love, the things we love, our place, our things, our people. In the early texts, that includes yourself. You're supposed to be easy to love, so there you go. We'll work on that one. But the idea is use this feeling, take this feeling that comes naturally in relation to the things we love, and learn how to expand it so that you can direct it toward everything. And so now let's use a little different language. We're used to loving the things that we like or that are familiar to us. And this practice suggests that we learn to love even the things that we don't like or are unfamiliar or that we fear. Really just the things that we don't know. And so much fear comes from not knowing, from not being in relationship, from non-contact. Right, this was the basis of Harvey Milk's thing about like everybody come out, all the gay people come out, because once all the scared, homophobic, straight people realize that your neighbor, your bus driver, your priest, your that one was complicated, your teacher, your kid's teacher, etc., were all gay, you would realize that these were all good people, and they were just your friends. And once you know people, you don't hate them. And this is the heart of representation and the beauty of plurality in general as an ideal that deep in its bones this country holds, but also contends with and in other times in other ways hates or fears plurality. We're one of the. It's interesting that, you know, America is this country devoted in a different way than many other countries to plurality. Because other than the folks who are indigenous, and that's its own tragedy, the dominant culture, everyone who came, is an immigrant from all over. And so it's almost like built on the trauma of the indigenous genocide was the possibility of there being this place where everyone came from elsewhere. And therefore, there's a plurality built in a way that's different in, like, you know, Sweden, where there's still something like an intact culture that started with indigenous folks and continued with folks embedded in that land for some time. And now they're contending with immigration, but it's very different than the way that we contend with it. So this virtue of plurality, like, oh, it's good to be in contact with those that are other. Once there's contact, there's familiarity, there's rubbing, there's a kind of sharing of culture, and there's a differences become lesser the more contact there is. This is, of course, what nationalism fears, is that the more contact there is, the less there will be difference, the more things will blur together. This is an ancient fear. Some of the ways that racism was so pervasively expressed in its early centuries, the early centuries of the colonial contact, was the fear of intermarriage. Oh, if we make contact with these other people, at some point somebody's going to marry them, and then they'll have kids, and then the whole situation of racial segregation or separateness starts to break down. And so then there are folks, wave after wave, in the colonial period, who find this a terrifying possibility. So now we're in this moment where another vast wave of global connection and contact has unfolded such that there's more contact than ever with difference. And folks embedded in the fear of difference, especially those who have been in positions of power and are losing that position of power, if only purely through demographics, but also through other aspects of culture unfolding, are lashing out in fear that their world, which is defined by identity, qualities that must be protected from dilution, is threatened. And having one's identity threatened is one of the deepest threats ever. So metta is this radical thing, the loving kindness practice. It says, yeah, it's easy to love the people that are like you. You already know how to do that. But that actually won't contribute to world peace at all. That'll contribute to peace in your community if you can keep the wall around that community high and strong. And then you can love the people that are like you, and you can cultivate a kind of ease of feeling safe if you've separated out difficulty. In a way, the feeling of kindness or benevolence or friendliness, these are all translations of the word metta, the Sanskrit is maitri, friendly. In a way, maybe this feeling comes from maybe it's a way of saying, this is what I feel like when I'm with my people, when I'm with the people with whom I feel safe. And as we talk about often, you know, we're animals that for much of our human evolution were in, you know, small groups that were essentially extended family systems. Some neuroscientists right now think that we can essentially track about 100 people in terms of like really knowing, you know, how everybody's life is going, what's happening for them, like who's your crew is like 100 people. Beyond that, you can't really track them, you know. And so I'm probably tracking several hundred people just on Facebook, you know, and some of those hundreds and other people I don't even know are tracking me, not to mention the bots. Hello, bots. Mm-hmm. They're tracking us too. You know, but I'm also tracking what's happening in, you know, in a certain way. I'm sure half of the countries in the world, I have some bead on what's going on there, right? I'm tracking just a little bit all of the countries in Europe. I'm tracking all the countries in the old Soviet Union. I'm tracking much of the Middle East. I'm tracking a good half each of South America and Africa and Southeast Asia, and, you know? But I can't do that. Like, my system is instantly overwhelmed actually trying to do that. And then any little thing, like, tips it over threshold. But this practice says, oh, if you think that you need to be familiar with the thing to love it, and this is that this is impossible, ultimately. Like, you can't actually be intimate with, feel safe with, in a personal way, every being everywhere. There's too much unknown. There's too much difference. You just don't know where people are at, and folks are dangerous. The metta practice assumes that there is danger in the world, right? That greed, hatred, and delusion is part of this human life. It's not to be eradicated. Metta is an antidote to ill will. We might say in a non-dual way that the world's actions unfold as a cycling of love and hatred all the time. So then here's this practice that says, take this feeling that you have for the people you love, for the places you feel safe with, and blow it open so that you aim it toward everyone. But how do you do that? You don't know them. You don't feel safe with them. How do I do that? At the end of the Metta Sutta, it says that one who is released from all fixed views, seeing clearly, is not born again into this, like, doesn't take birth again into suffering, isn't born again into this world. And part of what that suggests, I think, is that the practice of metta, to love everybody, actually means that we have to take on the project of wisdom that lets go of fixating on the small self. But it also means let's go of fixating on the self community, like my people. Loving everybody without exception is anti-nationalist. Right? To say, like, oh, my people versus your people, I can't do that if my practice is metta. Maybe I can say, you know, it's appropriate that there's appropriate boundaries in the world as part of the process of moving toward world peace. I can go there. You know, I could also go toward the argument that all borders should be illegal. It's a whole different question. Extremely complicated. But the metta practice points toward it. It says, what happens actually if I unbind affection from familiarity and I make it part of my constant nature to be applied without exception in all places? And so then the phrase that came to me was, oh, metta. Metta's a prayer for world peace. When you're saying, may all beings be safe, what we're saying is, may all the wars end. May everyone actually be safe. It's an absurd prayer. It's never been true, right? And so it becomes an orientation where I'm willing to let go of the illusion of safety that I get by confining my view to only those with whom I'm comfortable. And recognize that actually that sense of safety was always an illusion, and it was based on keeping the other at arm's length. And that's always going to mean that's based in resource inequity and power, maintenance of power to maintain boundaries. In that sense, it's a very different thing to do for one who's in a position of privilege and material safety versus one who's in danger. In a sense, for those who are in danger, it's appropriate to uplift the identity group, let's say, because it's being attacked. But the process ultimately will still ask that everyone who longs for peace eventually come to this practice of being unwilling to hold anyone as other or enemy. So then we just practice, starting with the folks we love, opening to the folks we don't know, and then blowing it open to just say, everyone, everyone. And we do this very difficult part of the practice where you send metta to the difficult people, right? The folks who you're afraid of, the folks who you don't like, the folks who you don't agree with, the folks who you would never vote for next week, but you can love them anyway. So just the suggestion that our practice is radical in the sense that to even imagine into the feeling of kindness for everyone everywhere requires that I soften so many parts of my identity that are fixated. Maybe it means that what if to love something is in a certain way to feel like it? In other words, to have enough connection to send love, I have to feel some kind of resonance with a being. I can't be completely disconnected and send love in an abstract way. I have to imagine some kind of connection. Even if I was to say, I'm going to send love to the beings, on that planet orbiting that distant star that I don't even know if they exist, but they might be out there, all beings, may they be well. I could do that in the abstract. But for it to be meaningful in my heart, I think I would have to imagine something about them. I'd have to be like, they must be beings who suffer. They must have consciousnesses or hearts or lives in some way that sending them love or the wish for their safety is meaningful at all. So then I have to imagine connection. So what if taking this feeling that I have for the folks that I like, extending it to everyone, also means, in a certain way, learning to feel like everyone? And again, this is a challenge to fixated identity. So in the Buddhist system, as you're clarifying the mind deeper and deeper in meditation and inquiry, and you reach what are called the paths and fruits, these are the stages of liberation. The first one is called stream entry. The second one is called once return, then non-return, then arahant. And they're characterized traditionally by the removal or weakening of 10 what are called fetters, things that bind us to suffering existence. And the very first level of this, stream entry, which is considered to be like, it's the thing that finally means you're not going to totally backslide and lose your way on the path. It's the thing that actually means there's momentum toward full liberation that's now unstoppable. One of the fetters that is eradicated in stream entry is personality view, called Sakkaya Ditti. The view that I am my personality, where personality basically means likes and dislikes. I'm the guy from Livermore who likes Brussels sprouts, doesn't like cantaloupe, likes Bernie, doesn't like Mitch. You know, I have my preferences, right? Likes tea, doesn't really like beer, you know, whatever. Preferences, yeah? Preferences is like the whole list of things I like and dislike. It's the whole way I organize my world. Those are just, in a sense, trivial preferences. Not the Brussels sprouts, but everything else is trivial. But like, what about the deep preferences? Things like what? Like deep preferences. Like the way that they almost don't sound like preferences, but the way of like oh, I was educated in a culture that reveres like rationality and judgment. I like those things. Mm. Right. Like, oh, that's what I went and got a doctorate. I'm a scholar. I like that. Or, you know, I like the aspect of American life that values freedom of religion or freedom of speech or freedom of assembly. I like those things. What if the uprooting of Sakkaya Ditti, personality view, means that I see through all of those aspects of my identity in terms of there being like the thing that I would call myself? This is me. And instead, you know, they're almost like, oh, you know, in my garden there happens to be this particular mixture of nitrogen and these minerals, and the tomatoes grow well in this spot and not well in that spot. And in a certain way, there's no judgment. It's just the ecosystem. I'm not going to be like, you know, somehow like it's this corner of the garden's fault. It's a bad corner if, you know, the tomatoes didn't grow so well in that spot versus that spot. It's just the ecosystem. What if I could be like, oh, the conditions have arisen in this body and this consciousness to favor these things and not favor these things, to prefer these things over these things. Mm-hmm. And I could be like, that's just the ecosystem. You know, I have the exact, we talked about this a month ago or so or more, I have the exact qualities that give me my position, positionality. What if that's just what has arisen here, but doesn't need to be clung to as a self? So the proposal here is that metta, as a prayer for world peace, requires that we soften this aspect of the fixated self. Because the more the self is fixated, the more it's different from others. The more it's different from others, the more there must be fear in the system. And so, in a way, we could say we uplift identity in the way that it preserves beauty and diversity and plurality and cultures, and in ways that it preserves the safety of people from harm. And then we soften separation in order to increase safety by making contact. And there's such a balance here, you know. And I want to say something to the, just as a, almost as a prayer, really, to the distinct identity of the Jews now, after the terrible anti-Semitic attack last week, a few days ago. I partly want to say it, speaking of positionality, in honor of my adoptive grandfather, Joel, who was Jewish and converted when he married and immigrated to this country. And in a very mysterious way, the conversion was so deep that I didn't find out about it till I was almost 40. And I went to my dad, his son, and I was like, "Dad, your dad, Jewish." And my dad was like, "Yeah." I was like, "You never said anything." He's like, "Oh, I don't know. I guess not." So just in honor of Joel, who passed away maybe 15 years ago or so, who was an accountant in Allentown, Pennsylvania. There's almost no more distinct and a kind of amazing example of what the power is in preserving an identity than what the Jewish people have done for so long to maintain a distinct religious and cultural and ethnic identity, or it's really several identities, ethnic identities, for thousands of years through so much hatred and trauma and diaspora without a homeland for so long. One of the most poignant writings that I read this weekend after the shooting were reflections on how the shooter had been really angry that the Jews had this Jewish community had supported this aid organization that was giving support to refugees. And so, in a way, made this kind of horrible connection of, like, you know, the Jews are supporting refugees, which means the migrant caravan, which could have terrorists in it from the Middle East, and just this whole sort of wing, sort of like tying together all the people we're afraid of in one, you know, kind of, vision of threat. And the writer, who was Jewish, said that, you know, like, yeah, this is this organization. We support refugees because we were strangers in the land of Egypt. And it was this beautiful, like, just, oh, that's ancient, right? Like, to say that and to say, like, because of this that happened, what, 6,000 years ago, depending on how you count, we know what it's like to be a people without a home, therefore we support those who are without a home. What a mystery that this people who has maintained an identity for so long I don't know what the end of that sentence is. Actually, maybe I just want to say that it's incredible that any people has succeeded in holding a distinct identity in a world of such chaos for so long. And that there must be, I just want to extend honor toward that. And that there's, I think the mystery for me is, oh, how do we now in a world where there essentially in so many ways are fewer borders than ever and more contact than ever, what will it mean for there to be distinct bodies of people who live together? And how do we both uphold identity and diversity and plurality and recognize that contact will create relationship and diminish difference, really, over time, more and more. And that process has an inherent tension, and where the tension is going to erupt in violence, and it does over and over and over. So then somehow this practice of metta says, oh, I'm willing to do this radical action of letting go of my isolation in order to urge through the power of my own feeling the possibility of there being peace in the world. And then I'm going to do that by actually making contact again and again with those that are different from myself. So just a blessing for all those suffering right now, and a blessing into the mystery of identity and difference, and what it means to live together on an increasingly small and rather crowded place. So maybe I'll invite here just a moment for your own felt sense in relation to any of this, in relation to the tragedy on Saturday, the condition of our world. You might feel what kind of the invitation of this metta practice. To love without border by making contact. But also by letting go of something in ourselves that would prevent that contact. As always with metta, it's not about having a certain feeling, but about connecting with the feeling that is there. So, blessings to everyone, and just some space for reflection together, your thoughts and feelings here. And really anything that's been up for you this week, really welcome to hear your voice here.
communicate a little more about when you started to talk about the difference, or I don't know if it was a difference, but just between like offering metta and loving kindness, but also like having boundaries and where boundaries are appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that relates to what you were saying, but it also relates to just having kind of like personal needs and then
yeah.
having relationships with any person in your life and how to like manage those
yeah.
relationships while like being loving but also getting
mm-hmm.
needs met.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's something in here around, there's so much in here about boundary where there's a kind of liberation that asks us to dissolve all boundaries. But not in a way that causes harm. So like, there is this radical suggestion that we develop a profound equanimity, that in a certain way, our own personal individual needs get very, very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the requisites that a monastic needs to live on is, you know, one meal a day, a couple of robes to keep you warm, like a couple of sheets basically to wrap around yourself to keep you warm, some medicine, you know, place to sleep. That could be, if you believe the early texts, you know, a heap of straw, the root of a tree, an empty hut. Like, not much. Very, very, very simple. So that's perhaps not much help for us in complicated relationships who are not monastics, who are like, well, I do have more needs than that. So there is an encouragement toward a radical reevaluating of our needs, based in being willing to tolerate discomfort in all sorts of ways. But if we really take the precepts to mind, then there's like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm engaged in a practice of working toward liberation, like trying to see through the places that bind me and the things that I get caught on and where the mind gets constricted, the heart gets constricted. But if the precepts are the foundation, then that means, you know, doing that, but not in a way that would cause harm. You know, so if someone's, let's say, causing you harm emotionally, let's say, you know, or physically, certainly, it's appropriate to see that clearly, to know what's happening, to have a boundary or ask for help in creating a boundary, to figure out how to keep yourself safe purely out of respecting the precepts, like to not cause yourself harm. So I think appropriate boundary preserves well-being, preserves basic safety, physical safety, emotional safety as best we can. And then beyond that, maybe we're working to discern the difference between what's a boundary that's there for health versus a boundary that's there for preference.
Mm-hmm.
Like, today I got a note from someone in a course that I taught who had some critical feedback, you know, that was, you know, relatively not pointed. The person wrote in to say, I really don't like online courses. I can't do it. I can't deal with the technology. I don't feel like this was, you know, the way I wanted to study in this course. And I'm like, okay, not your jam. But like, you know, it was not praise anyway, right? And so my heart sank for a moment. I was like, oh, darn. I so want everything I do to be liked by everybody.
Right.
Basically, like, okay, I'm not going to get that. You know, we already lost two tonight. I mean, maybe they just have to go to sleep. You know, cheers. It's cool. One never knows. But
ascended.
You never know. Totally. The meditation was enough to enlighten them, and they were like, done. But, like, for, I don't want to have a boundary that is somehow defensive in a way, to be like, oh, I don't want to receive, you know, critique. So I want to actually discern the difference between, like, when am I caring for safety and well-being, and when am I preserving comfort, basically, and one might even say privilege, you know, the privilege
or
of staying,
identity.
or identity in that way. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, there's so much in that piece about identity, you know, that comes into things that we've talked about in here recently, you know, layers like white fragility, for instance, and aspects of privilege, you know, being challenged on unconscious expressions of privilege is uncomfortable, but ultimately with an intention toward healing, I don't want to have a boundary against that. I want to welcome, you know, being called out, or what we now call called in if it's done with kindness, you know. So that's the main distinction I want, that comes up for me, right, is like, oh, if I can't tell, then I go back to the precepts. I'm like, is there harm? And how to prevent harm. But I will say that it does seem like the suggestion in the practice is to challenge our own comfort to an extraordinary degree, you know, such that we become willing actually to be in contact with that which is different or that which is uncomfortable, based in the sincere desire for liberation, to not isolate, so to open the boundaries as much as possible, in the interest of safety for all. I don't know if that necessarily answers directly the aspect of your question that's about personal relationship. The standard answer is that boundaries are good. and I think mostly that's true, you know.
I guess it would be like, what is love? Which is a way bigger question, but like to have boundaries and to share, to show love. Like,
yeah.
I'm not even necessarily asking you to answer that. I'm just curious about.
Totally, totally. I don't answer questions of that scope in the last 3 minutes of class. What is love? That's my boundary. I only answer questions like that when we have a full 10 minutes left.
Well, but it's pretty encompassing, because it's not just loving in relationship, but it's also loving yourself. I mean, that lends itself, I think, to the boundaries,
right,
naturally.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And to the no harm, like if it's causing you harm, then that creates a healthy boundary. Mm-hmm.
That's about the question of
right? Yeah, please do. I mean, when you feel the thing that you call love, what is it? Like, what's happening? It depends on the love. There's different kinds, right?
And not all love is easy.
I think most of the stuff that deserves the name often isn't, right? Mm. Like, it asks something fierce of us.
I just came up with it's not directly answering your question, but I was just thinking about this idea that, like, if everyone was completely, like, in the state of loving kindness, or like what I see is like really like open and accepting of everything that's happening, or then would we need boundaries as much or at all?
Would we even exist as such? But yeah, like like, it's an appropriate boundary for me to know that I'm me and you're you, right? You have all your identity, I have my identity. If I was loving you in a way that I was just like fully supporting the entirety of your being,
mm-hmm.
to be yourself, there's some way that that love could, it could feel to me like a delight in you being you, but it could also be like a delight in contact with you. It could also be like layers of appreciation, all sorts of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we know that there's also kinds of love where you know, if we got entangled in some way,
mm-hmm.
I might forget that you were you and I'm me.
Right.
And, you know, as someone who's been married for a decade and some, like, that starts to cause harm eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if we really forget each other's distinctness,
mm-hmm.
right? And things get mergy and there's projection, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's healthy releasing of boundary and there's unhealthy releasing of boundary. And so I think this is why this question often should be responded to by saying, work on healthy boundary first.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like, let's get psychologically healthy
mm-hmm.
as best we can. And that's a foundation for the kind of unbinding that goes more toward the non-dual eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, get mature as best we can through the layers where I might forget appropriate boundary and therefore cause harm in my actions. And then as that matures, I begin to sense into what's possible in a less differentiated field. So that's a process that I see people in intimate relationship go through, like kind of arcs of merging and unmerging, you know, over
mm-hmm.
time. Kind of as we figure out like what does it mean to be in constant contact and then to each change and grow in contact. So then what if that's true not just about like an intimate partnership, but let's say it's true about, you know, multiple racial or cultural groups sharing the same piece of land. And we're gonna all change and grow and as our intimacy unfolds. What if we thought about all the different immigrant groups in the United States, let's say in North America, but including the indigenous folks? What if we thought of everyone in you know, intimate relationship with each other, a kind of marriage that was, you know, some of the aspects of that marriage were not chosen, so there's harm there. And then others were chosen in different ways, and there's intimacy. And then we have to figure out how to be in this, like, crazy, plural, intimate relationship with all these people, all of these groups that are so different. Bring the wisdom that we might bring to intimate relationships, to our civic life. Maybe amid the chaos there would be a little bit more love possible. So thanks for asking what is love. Thanks for coming and being present on a week where there's some mourning to be done. And just for your depth of practice, as always, it's really a pleasure to share these conversations and this world with you. So thank you for being here. Thanks for your offerings in support of the group, sustaining us through your generosity. For folks that are new, your offerings are central in the maintaining of a group that's free for everyone to come join. So thank you for your generosity. And money can be left in the red box or at the desk in various ways, or on my website, of course. As always, take good care. Vote if you haven't yet. And see you next week. See you on voting day next week, right?
Yeah. right.
Totally. Totally.